This is episode number 3 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, March 8, 2007. I'm Jared Brito. Up for discussion this week, Wikipedia and the SJ controversy, age verification for online content, and first responder communications. Joining me to discuss these topics are Adam Thierer.
Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Adam. Tim Lee.
Hello.
Hello, and Braden Cox.
Hey, Jerry.
Hello, Braden. These are contributors to the Technology Liberation Front all. First up, Wikipedia and SJ. Tim, who is SJ and what is all the fuss?
SJ is a longtime member of the Wikipedia community who was featured in an article in the New Yorker a few months back, and it recently came out that he was not, in fact, he had claimed that he was a college professor studying theology, and worse than that, in the course of arguments about content on Wikipedia, he had been caught citing his non-existent credentials to bolster his position on various aspects of Catholic theology, I believe was the topic in most cases, and it came to light that he was not, in fact, a professor of anything. He was a 24-year-old kid in Kentucky, I believe. And so this came to light, and it generated quite a lot of controversy. And there were some bloggers, with I think Nick Carr leading the charge, making the argument that basically this demonstrates that Wikipedia can't be trusted, and that that really it's not a reliable source since there are people like this contributing to it.
And isn't there something to that? I mean, I understand the sort of the argument that you have to stand or fall by what you produce or what your arguments are. But isn't there something icky about this? Was this one of the top people at Wikipedia turns out to be a big fraud?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's a mistake to do what Jimmy Wales did initially, which is to say, well, that's sort of, you know, what he does in his personal life, and it's not, you know, it has nothing to do with Wikipedia at all for two reasons. One is that, as you say, I mean, it does matter, do the people who are running this project have integrity or not? And number two, as I noted, he is involved in, or he did attempt to use his credentials to bolster the positions he was arguing for within the community, and obviously that undermines the model to somewhat. But I think the mistake is to read too much into it, because ultimately, what's different about Wikipedia compared with more traditional media sources is that Wikipedia's editing model does not require, does not depend on the credibility or the reputation of any particular contributor for getting the right answer. They state up front that that Wikipedia is not an authoritative source that you should be citing in academic papers and so forth. What they attempt to do is to organize the already existing consensus information, of which there's a great deal, and it's very useful to have it all organized in one place, but they're not a primary source. They don't do original research. And so, in some sense, if you're evaluating, is a particular piece of information I found on Wikipedia accurate or not, it matters very little whether any particular person who contributed to that content has integrity or not, because you have many, many eyes looking at the same article, and if something inaccurate is put in there, either someone will catch that or someone will flag it as uncited. You'll often come to a Wikipedia article where there's a flag that says, you know, this article needs more citations, and over time, as more citations are added, anybody can come along and verify independently that the information is correct or not.
Hey, Tim, let me ask you a question. I mean, what you seem to be saying, and I know some others have said, is that it's generally accepted now that when most people come to Wikipedia, they understand it's sort of a caveat emptor kind of situation. You know, it's not buyer beware, but sort of surfer beware. You know, not everything you're reading here is, you know, holy law or anything. I mean, there's going to be some mistakes. There's going to be some things that need to be added or corrected over time. That being said, there have been arguments made by those who are passionate about Wikipedia that it is a potential sort of replacement model for the future of Britannia and other types of encyclopedias. Or, moreover, there's the question about what about the people who go and don't have the attitude that potentially you and I and others have of, again, caveat emptor. I mean, like, I consider my kids. I mean, my kids will probably, in a few years when they start writing term papers, they might turn to Wikipedia before they turn to Britannia or something else. That raises the question of, okay, do they understand that they have to take it with a grain of salt or that there may be these mistakes? I think that's what the critics are trying to get at, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think there's some validity to that. Keep in mind, though, that you would not encourage your kids to use Britannia as an authoritative source either. An encyclopedia is not designed to be an authoritative source on any particular topic. The purpose of an encyclopedia is to give you sort of a first cut of background information. And if you're really serious about a subject, whether you're using Wikipedia or a more traditional encyclopedia, you really should look at the citations in the encyclopedia and see what's behind it, what sources they're relying on.
Right.
But the other point that I think is important to keep in mind is that in some ways I think SJ is to peer production what Enron is to the free market. It's if you're looking at, in some sense it's statistical, if you're looking at a randomly chosen Wikipedia article, the odds that the one bad apple was the guy who made the final decision on any particular sentence in Wikipedia is very, very low, just as the odds that if you pick a random corporation, the odds that you're going to end up dealing with Enron is very, very low. And so on average, these decentralized sort of spontaneous ordered processes give you a better result in the aggregate, even though there's nobody in particular guaranteeing that every single transaction or every single sentence of content is correct. On the average, it can produce equal or even better accuracy than more hierarchical, traditionally run efforts.
Well, Tim, I think that's a good point, but let me ask you this. What is it that the critics, like, say, Nick Carr or Seth Finkelstein and some of the others that are out there, what is it exactly that they're looking for in terms of a fix? Because I do agree with you. A lot of their criticism seems to be based on almost sort of like Wikipedia hatred almost. I don't know if it's envy or what, but I can't quite explain the vicious nature of some of the criticism. That being said, I can appreciate their critique of the lack of transparency at times or problems like this not being corrected quickly enough. But what do they want to do? I mean, what exactly it's unclear to me what the critics exactly think the solution should be here.
Yeah, I agree with that. I don't quite understand it either because, well, Seth Finkelstein actually did sort of answer this question in some comments on TLF, and basically what he said is he just doesn't like Wikipedia. He thinks that the people participating in it are being exploited, that they're sort of dupes of Jimmy Wales, and they're contributing free content without getting properly compensated. And it sort of sounds to me very much like sort of old-fashioned critiques of capitalism, that workers are being exploited and not getting their due. And my attitude is just that, you know, if you don't like the deal you're getting from Wikipedia, either as a reader or as a contributor, you know, nobody's forcing you to participate, and you're still free to buy, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, I think most people really are finding that Wikipedia is very useful, and that I think Britannica is probably going to go out of business pretty quick. So in the long run, you might not have the choice. But again, that's just the market at work. The vast majority of people, I think, are better served. So it's not clear to me what the alternative is. Now, I do think it's worth noting that in a matter of hours after this story broke, or maybe, I don't know, I guess it was 2 or 3 days, the Wikipedia community itself put an enormous amount of pressure on Jimmy Wales to fire SJ. And I think the story broke on like a Wednesday or Thursday, and by the Saturday, Jimmy Wales announced that he'd asked him to resign. So I think that the Wikipedia critics had a much, much better argument on Thursday or Friday when Jimmy Wales was still arguing that we should keep him on the staff there. I think it's much harder to argue that there's no accountability now that he has, in fact, been fired.
All right. Thanks a lot, Tim. So moving on, we've got age verification for online content. Adam, what is this debate about, and what happened in Connecticut recently?
Well, Jerry, of course, many people know that recently there's been a lot of heat put on social networking websites like MySpace.com, Zanga, Facebook, and so on to age verify their users, with the specific intent being to try to either keep adults off the sites that kids like to traffic or to keep kids under a certain age, say under the age of 13 or 14, off sites altogether. Of course, it's a very complicated thing, and there's a lot of issues, troubling issues in terms of privacy concerns and others raised by age verification, but that hasn't stopped a lot of state attorneys general from really turning up the heat on this front and suggesting that something needs to be done or demanding that something be done to age verify, even though there's no good models for it. Anyway, this week, Attorney General Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut announced legislation requiring social networking sites to age verify users by obtaining parental consent before any profiles of minors could be posted online. And the sites that fail to get that parental consent, however that's going to be done, would face civil penalties of something like $5,000 per violation, so I guess per profile that was allowed it to be posted without parental consent. And then it also allows for individuals, such as parents or others, to bring private lawsuits against social networking sites. What's so interesting about this is that the legislation apparently would even go further and require that parents be somehow checked or verified, because after all, there's a concern about, is it just another kid verifying another kid pretending to be their parent or a dirty uncle or something? Well, this legislation would basically say, no, we not only need to age verify the kids, we need to verify the adults. And that's going to be done with apparently submitting information via email, fax, signed forms, potentially even things like follow-up calls, they suggested. So, you know, this is really getting quite extreme. I mean, I don't want to go so far as to say this is the beginnings of a national ID card movement again. But, of course, that's already going on, as Jim Harper told us last week. So this plays into the hand of those who want to expand the broader surveillance state kind of mentality. And so I think this is something to be watchful of, because there are at least three states now that are pursuing this. Attorney General Blumenthal suggested this week that as 10 to 20 states are considering similar types of legislation for social networking sites.
This is part of a broader trend, I think, where we're trying to treating e-commerce sites differently than what we would see in classified ads in a newspaper or things like that. And there's always been this disparate treatment, I think, ever since e-commerce began. But it seemed like before it was kind of more dealing with kind of indirect regulation, the avoiding the middleman type of thing, and you saw kind of favorable treatment to those who were already entrenched, like the real estate industry or things like that. Now it really seems like, you know, the 2.0 buzzword is becoming more and more, you see that more often, but really we're kind of re-entering a new e-commerce regulation 2.0, and it's disparate treatment, and it's flat on treating e-commerce differently, and we see this even with online dating sites, and the fact that we think there's some sort of security and background checks there too for people who might list on these sites. And the reality is that child predators and convicted criminals, they don't use online dating services to find their victims. They'll lurk around chat rooms or virtual playgrounds or even other school yards, even in the old-fashioned way, and that's the reality there.
Brandon, weren't you saying that there was some sort of regulation New Jersey was proposing about online dating sites?
New Jersey has proposed that online dating sites will tell customers whether criminal background screenings are done or not, if in fact they don't require that. And, of course, this is something that we've seen in other states, too, and it's behind one company called True.com that has partnered with a background check company to do these things. And essentially they're looking to enshrine in regulation their business model and force others to comply. And even in New Jersey, the state AG is against this because he thinks that this would provide a false sense of security for consumers. And I think that's the reality is that a lot of this just requires education and just general wherewithal while on the Internet, just like when you're off the Internet.
You know, Brad, the irony of this is that in many cases, some AGs are saying that we need to have age verification for social networking sites for teens and youngsters that mimics the age verification we see on, or the identity authentication we see on certain dating sites, because that's considered sort of like the best stuff out there. But the difference is that, of course, in many cases, for the adult sites that are involved in online dating, the adults often want to be authenticated and even age verified because it might help them in terms of going out and seeking to find a date. But mm-hmm. that is definitely not the case with most social networking websites, certainly not MySpace, where you're talking about usually kids and kids who don't want to be age verified, Moreover, if you do want to try to age verify, none of the tools or databases or information that are at our disposal to verify adults are available for kids. Kids don't have driver's licenses, they don't have credit cards, they usually don't have military records, they don't have home mortgages, car loans, anything like that. So you have to have some sort of a plan like the AGs are talking about where you get the parents to do it all for them. But then, as you said, there's a false security question about what happens about the predator who has a kid who gets online under that kid's name or alias, and all of a sudden you've got people lurking under a false identity. It's better, I think, that kids have a sort of, you know, an attitude about them, like, I need to be careful and be told, like, you know, be careful who you trust information to it with and don't talk to random strangers, that kind of thing, as opposed to all of a sudden they're befriending someone who's actually a 45-year-old man pretending to be a 13-year-old.
And I think, I think we need to emphasize also that this is something that would have to apply to all adults too, right? Because obviously if you said anybody under 18 has to verify their age, you know, all the under 18s would just register as 18-year-olds. So this means that every single person who signs up for any sort of social networking, if I'm not mistaken, would have to go through this rigmarole of having some government agency or somebody verify how old they are.
That's right, Tim. And, of course, then the question becomes, who's verifying? How much data are they collecting? Where is that data being stored, retained? Who has access to it? All those privacy questions are raised. And then there's another question, and this is the one that I try to point out in a new paper I'm doing on this subject, which is that let's not forget we're talking about something that is a global platform. I mean, social networking is not just strictly an American kind of thing. I mean, kids can go anywhere, and the sites can go anywhere. And the last thing we want to do is discourage kids from using what I would regard as more mainstream and very safe websites, such as MySpace and Zanga and so on, and make them or encourage them to go to the sort of potentially truly shady alleys of the Internet, offshore somewhere in, I don't know, Thailand or, you know, something like that, where we have no control or say or persuasive abilities over the website operators. And that's a huge danger here because kids will get online and they'll find a way to get on sites and communicate with each other. But I think a lot of policymakers want to pretend that they can somehow regulate all of this, and they've created a moral panic around social networking that is just completely irrational. And yet I really think we're on our way to regulation of these sites, however they're defined, which is another issue. How do you define these things?
Adam, one question too. Isn't the point really here, doesn't the crime happen offline? I mean, how many people seem to forget that, actually?
Oh, absolutely.
The crime is happening offline.
I mean, if anything, you know, in the old days, the social networking sites that all four of us grew up going to were called video arcades and shopping malls. You know, when we probably told our parents we were taking our bikes to go to a friend's house, they had no idea where we're at. At least with an online social networking site, the kid's usually in the house on a computer, and if they're actually going to interact with a predator, they've actually got to go somewhere and do it. Mm-hmm. And what I show in my new report is that we actually have solid statistics on who are these kids that actually take that leap, that make that awful leap of faith into thinking, I can trust this random stranger, I can go meet with them. And it's really disturbing stuff, because what these surveys have revealed is that there's a very small percentage of high-risk, at-risk youth who are susceptible to predation. These are kids in broken homes, often without families or parents present, or parents with bad relationships, or they're kids who are struggling with their sexuality or exploring their sexuality, and they don't have anybody to talk to. And what happens? They end up falling into relationships with older adults and then getting hurt. But the statistics, amazingly, this is true statistics, only 5% of all the perpetrators of child abuse in follow-up surveys with online predation, only 5% of the perpetrators pretended that they were underage. Only 5%. And kids met with these people after knowing that. And 80% of these predators, 80% of them, made it clear to the kids they had sexual intentions. And the kids still met with them. But who were the kids? They were the at-risk kids from broken homes. You cannot extrapolate from those statistics that this is a problem that is universal, that is true of all kids. Most kids don't take that leap of faith. They say, get out of here, you creep. Mm-hmm. And yet our policymakers have made a moral panic around this and said, look, we've got a small problem. Oh, no, it's a problem of the whole Internet. We've got to age verify everybody. And now we're on our way to basically a national ID card system for kids.
All right. Well, you know, I can't top that. The last thing we're going to talk about, something I've been following closely, which is first responder communications. And basically the idea is that police and firefighters, you watch movies and you think that they can just talk to each other whenever they have a need to. But we've seen, you know, after 9/11, after Katrina, after the Oklahoma City bombing, each time police and fire can't talk to each other and people die as a result. And after each of those events, what you have is a blue ribbon commission that's appointed that invariably comes back with the same solution, which is more spectrum and more money for first responders. And you know, that hasn't worked. And the reason it hasn't worked is because of the policy that the spectrum and the money is doled out. And the way that's done is that the FCC gives a license, gives spectrum to each police department, to each fire department in every town across America, and that comes up to about 50,000 of them. And this works great because it's by giving them their own license, they can have the flexibility to build a radio system that really matches their needs. The downside of that is that when they build a custom system, it's not going to be compatible with their next-door neighbors. So you have towns where in the same town, the police and fire and the ambulance can't talk to each other because they've got completely incompatible systems. So what has Congress done about this? Well, after the 9/11 report, Congress said, okay, we'll give more spectrum and more money. And with the digital TV transition, they're going to get back from broadcasters who are switching from analog to digital TV 84 megahertz of prime spectrum in a 700 megahertz band. So from that 84, they're going to take 24 and give it to public safety, and then they're going to take 60, and they're going to auction it for commercial wireless uses. So the FCC has a proceeding right now deciding what to do with the 24 megahertz, and they finally, I guess, have gotten the idea that doling it out into little chunks is not the best way to go. And so they're having a proceeding to maybe create a national broadband network, and I can talk about that in a minute. But what's interesting is that you've had a couple companies come out who have the right idea, which is get private firms involved in building national networks that public safety users can subscribe to, just like, you know, all of us subscribe to cell phones, and you know, we can all interoperate perfectly no matter what network we're on. So have public safety subscribe to these networks, and whatever capacity isn't used on the network, commercial subscribers or consumers can subscribe to it, and that, you know, in that way increase the economies of scale. And what you have Morgan O'Brien, who is one of the founders of Nextel. He started a company called Siren Call. And what Siren Call wants to do is take, he says, you know, the 24 megahertz that was given for public safety, that just isn't enough, and that doesn't work for technical reasons that, you know, we can't get into here and that are disputed. And he's saying what we need is up to 60 megahertz that, you know, that is up for auction, for commercial auction, we need 30. And what first happened was that he was basically saying we need you to give 30 to a national trust that will then choose private firms to build out a network. Of course, you know, if you take away 30 megahertz from the 60th, half of all of the spectrum available for auction, number one, you're going to have a big shortfall in the federal budget that basically is coming from these auctions. And number two, you're not going to have the spectrum going to new innovation and lower prices that are going to come from commercial wireless companies building out over it. So since then Siren Call has said, well, we want to buy it. But of course, the way they want to buy it is with federal loan guarantees that they would get if their plan passes. After that, Frontline Wireless, which is a group that was started by Reed Hundt and Janice Obuchowski, Reed Hundt being a former FCC director and Janice Obuchowski being a former NTIA director. They want to buy spectrum at auction and build a national network, which is a great idea, except what they want is for the FCC to say that the spectrum that they want to buy can only be used for public safety. And of course, if you do that, then the value of the spectrum drops and they can buy it at a cheaper price. And my question is, you have dozens and dozens of megahertz of spectrum available that is already allocated for public safety. Why don't we auction off that spectrum, allow private firms to bid on it, and build the networks?
Wouldn't there be a transition problem where, if you got, St. Louis has a public safety or a broadcast or a public safety system that's built on a particular chunk of spectrum and you auction that off, wouldn't there be some difficulties with what would St. Louis do while they were in the process of rolling out this new network?
Yeah, two things about that. First is, and this is all disputed, this is all kind of technical, so something that needs to be sorted out. One thing is that there is lots of spectrum that has been allocated for public safety, but that really is not in use. It hasn't been assigned, and police and fire are not using it right now. So if that's the case, we can take that spectrum and use it. Now, even assuming that we need to use some of the spectrum that's now up for auction, well, number two is the 24 megahertz that is coming from a DTV transition, we know for a fact is not being used right now. We're deciding what to do with it now. But lastly, even if we have to use some or all of the spectrum that's up for auction, for commercial auction, well, then the moment you decide to do that, you should also have a directive that says identify an equal amount in public safety that once a transition is over, you can then auction for commercial.
Sure.
And Jerry, on top of all of this, isn't there aren't there efforts being made to claim a big chunk of this spectrum as well for various types of unlicensed and commons-related purposes, which means even less, you know, for private dedicated uses and, of course, also less money for the budget?
Right. No, and that's definitely the case. You have the white spaces proceeding, and the idea is that you would have guard bands between different assignments of spectrum, and that those would be basically a commons. And of course, the problem there is that you would have less space for commercial wireless technologies to take place.
And the white spaces issue, couldn't it be the case that if there is more space in the so-called white spaces, that it too could be auctioned off?
No, absolutely. And when we have technology gets better and better at eking out more and more capacity, these smaller spaces become more valuable. And right now you need big, with TV you needed huge guard bands between channels. Now they've gotten smaller and smaller and smaller.
Right.
And if you have private rights over these spaces, they can be traded off in smaller and smaller chunks.
But Jerry, bottom line, isn't the thing that probably is going to work to our favor on this, in the sense that we would like to see more spectrum auction and for private use, the fact that at the end of the day it's congressional greed that's going to carry the day, and the fact that they want to inflate their own treasury and their budgets.
No,
fact they've already paid they've already paid for a bunch of programs in like 2012 from money that they are estimating from right now, correct?
No, I think that's right. But never underestimate the appeal of first responders.
Sure,
I think
sure.
Somebody said, you never pick a fight with a police officer because you're going to lose.
Right.
And John McCain has introduced legislation that would do. It's funny because when John McCain announced this legislation about a month ago, he said that he would introduce the legislation. The plan that he sort of outlined was the siren call plan. But then when the legislation finally was introduced, really, siren call was an alternative. He's saying first, let's auction off some of the spectrum, kind of in the frontline wireless sort of way. And if that doesn't work, then we can go with siren call. And when you have that many options backed by somebody like John McCain, and with police and fire really putting on the pressure, and they're organized, they're really well organized. Never doubt the telecom lobby, I guess, either. But it's not going to be a slam dunk, I don't think.
No, it's not, and I've actually seen some of these guys. They go up to the hill together. You have
they're wearing their uniforms.
They are. Fire chiefs wear their fire helmets, and police officers come up dressed to the T. And they say, "We're here together to ask for more spectrum." And it's easy to get a sympathetic audience when you do that.
Yeah.
By the way, shameless plug: PFF is hosting a big event on this issue with a fire chief tomorrow, and some other people, including Janice Obachowski, on Capitol Hill. That's free and open to the public at noon.
That's Friday, March 9th.
Yes.
All right. So let's move on. Before we go, are there any other quick bits that caught your attention this week?
You mentioned data retention. It's definitely been in the news for the past few weeks now. I just think it's kind of falling into what Adam was mentioning before, this movement for protecting us online that's overinflated and causes more unintended consequences and harms than it will actually solve. And data retention falls right into that. What I would like to see is let the government hold on. If they want businesses to collect the data, let the government retain it. Don't put that burden on...
The problem there is that that's probably unconstitutional. And so my question is, if it's unconstitutional for the government to do it, well, then if they're forcing the companies to do it, well, isn't that basically deputizing them? And if they're deputizing them, well, aren't they basically actors of acting as part of the state? And if so, how is that not unconstitutional in itself?
I don't know how, on the one hand, we abhor and we're afraid of companies gathering data on us, and then you hear about consumer activists all the time on this issue. But on the other hand, it's fine if they do that. So I don't understand where we are on that issue still.
One thing I heard this week, some scuttlebutt here in town, is that apparently the DOJ has been quite aggressively meeting with the various companies, internet companies, and ISPs involved in this. And from what I've heard, and this is just a rumor, there's essentially an effort underway by the DOJ to sort of split the camp. So what I've been saying recently in my work and blogs on this is that basically the really interesting thing about the data retention fight is that it's one of the few fights that I know of in modern tech policy that unifies almost everybody in industry, all the e-commerce guys, all the Bell guys, cable guys, ISPs, everybody. It's almost like the old clipper chip fight. And it's an incredible dynamic. It's like an us versus them, industry versus government kind of fight. But what's interesting is what I heard this week is that DOJ has apparently been trying to sort of like split that movement apart a bit by putting a lot more pressure on the ISPs and the broadband providers than on the actual e-commerce guys. Mm. And what that might end up doing is getting some of the e-commerce and internet content guys and others, say like Google and Yahoo and others, to take pressure off or not worry about the issue and leave the fight to sort of like a Verizon, Comcast, Time Warner, those guys fighting it on their own, with them bearing the brunt of the initial mandates. Of course, the government's game plan there is quite brilliant, because if that's what they're trying to do, then basically the e-commerce companies go, you know, hide in the corner for a while and say, well, thank God they're not kicking our butts around. Plus, of course, those e-commerce companies have no love lost with those broadband guys because of the net neutrality fight. And so, ultimately, you could have a mandate go in for just ISPs and say it's 2 years with IP addresses only, but then all of a sudden in 2 or 3 years' time it's reopened, the length of time or the breadth of the mandate is expanded, and then goes on to include various types of search or e-commerce or even social network site or other types of companies like that. So I'm really horrified what I think is about to happen, and I will guarantee you that we get some sort of data retention thing in this Congress before it's over.
Wow. Well, that's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. Thank you guys for chiming in.
Thanks a lot.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. Goodbye.